Cool, and I kept the profanities to a minimum this time.
Yeah.
Oh, that was good.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. You guys can add some mofos in there if you want, just so that people believe it's still me.
Do you just want to go on for a couple minutes just to kind of so we can bleep those in?
Right.
Everywhere?
Like, I'll do a lot of different inflections for the mofo, and you guys can insert them back in.
There you go.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Pixel Hub podcast. I'm Brian Collins, and with me is Dan Lefebvre. Dan, we have got a great show today, and it's a person that I know you know very well because you've done a lot of interviews with him. Why don't you go ahead and tell everybody who that is?
Yeah, we have Shadi Safadi, who was a concept artist at Naughty Dog. Now he's running his own concept art studio, One Pixel Brush. I mean, he's got some of the best advice and insights into the concept art industry and the whole inner workings of really high-level, AAA-level games and movies.
And you first met him at GDC, right? You attended one of his sessions where he did a talk?
Yeah, he did a talk at GDC, and then after the talk, I had a chance to chat with him. And then following up after GDC, we did an interview, which led into some articles that we have on our blog, kind of going behind his business and that aspect, but wanted to reach out to him again to chat on the podcast and kind of go a little bit further beyond some of the stuff that we've covered in the article itself.
Yeah, and there were three different installments of that article series, right, for One Pixel Brush and Shadi, right?
Yeah, yeah. One of them kind of goes over his origins, kind of where he came from, and then his transition into running a business. Mm-hmm. And then the next one kind of goes into the business side and kind of how he runs his business. And then the final article goes into how really his advice for becoming a concept artist and kind of how he does that. And that goes into the four zones of awesomeness, which we talk about in the interview here as well.
And so to give our readers, our listeners and readers, some context behind this, right? Mm-hmm. If they haven't already gone to the blog and read these articles, these four zones of awesomeness that he told you about in the sessions you went to at GDC.
Yeah.
Can you give us a brief, really brief explanation of what these are so that people listening will understand?
Well, if you haven't read the articles, I'd highly advise that you go do that, because that'll Shadi's explanation of it is a lot better than mine will be. But just real quickly, basically what Shadi did was take with the experience that he has of being at the high level for concept art. What does it take to get to that? Because he obviously didn't start there, right? So he started and really had an experience that a lot of artists struggle with of trying to find his passion. So he went through really a really great transition from trying to find his passion and struggling and almost even getting or almost getting fired at one point, all the way into leading one of the premier concept art studios out there. And so he took kind of some of the concepts from that experience and broke it down into four different things. There are cheatinginess, sexiness, as he calls them, a storytellinginess, kind of making up some words there, and then the final one being classiness.
Classy. So we've got cheatiness, sexiness, storytellingness, and classiness. And they sort of storytellingness. All right. So these things sort of describe themselves, right? So cheatiness means basically to be willing to go out there and learn from other people and to actively seek out other people to mimic. All right. Whether you want to call that cheating or not is sort of where you stand in the in the context of that situation.
Right. And there's some sub aspects of each of those four things.
Okay.
Which in the article there is a kind of a diagram that Shadi gave us to put on there. But the ways that you go about that are going to be different, right? Because you might look up to somebody who has a cartoony style, or you might look up to somebody who has a photoreal style, and the methods that you take to get there are going to be different. But the overall point is not to kind of find your way, but to just look at somebody who's already made it, mm-hmm. and then go from point A to point B. You want to get to where they're at. What's the fastest way to get there?
Mm-hmm. And if you have to do some cheating.
In the
sense that you're stealing ideas so that you can better yourself and get to your art god.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember who it was that said it, but it, you know, creativity is just forgetting where your reference was from or something like that. Yeah. But they've already made it, uh-huh. right? And so why try to reinvent the wheel?
Okay, so that's cheatiness. What about sexiness? What does he mean by that? I mean, I'm sexy, but I'm still a horrible artist. I'm not very successful.
Well, I mean, that's going to be all the polish and all that side aspect of it. Once again, I mean, I don't, off the top of my head, I don't remember all the sub zones to them, but they're all in that diagram and they're explained in the article as well.
Okay, so just having that sort of je ne sais quoi, that sexiness or whatever, this makes you stand out as an individual.
Yeah.
Okay, and storytellingness, the ability to be able to tell a story, right? Classiness.
Yeah, making sure that doesn't fall outside of the design. Because at the end of the day, when you're creating art, your concept art, or really any sort of art, you want it to tell a story.
Sure, yeah. Okay, yeah. Sounds great. Well, we'll get right down to it, folks. We're going to talk about all of this and more. So without further ado, here's Shadi Safadi.
All right, so I just thought we could start off with just kind of going over a quick overview of your background and what you're doing now at One Pixel Brush.
Right, okay, so my background was obviously I started at Idle Minds, actually, in Colorado. I graduated art school, went to Art Center, College of Design, that's in Pasadena, and really struggled at art school because I didn't have really discipline or a clear style. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And concept art kind of came into the picture about halfway through art school, because this was like back in 2002, 2001. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really concept art as a field because games weren't evolved enough. You know, if Mario has a brown pixel for a belt, then no one needs to design that belt. But, you know, as things get more elaborate now, it's like, well, what kind of belt is it? And what does that belt say about that person's character? You know, I think the entire video game industry had to evolve in that our attention to detail and nuance and storytelling basically was forged in that first 10 years when the fidelity went up, you know, and that's why, you know, the initial games from a storytelling perspective. And when I say storytelling, I don't mean the literal story. I mean, like, the visual story, like, again, like, is the belt a little bit too rugged for Drake, or is it the right ruggedness? Is it a dress belt, or is it a rugged belt? Now, it could be something that, like, you never thought of in your life on your own, which most of us, no guys really ever thought about what their belt says about their outfit. But we started having to pay attention to that sort of thing, and that came online as the graphics got better, you know, with PlayStation and stuff. So art school, I graduated and you know, had a weak portfolio, you know, that wasn't that great because I didn't work that hard in school and I was a little bit of an egomaniac and then I thought I knew things that I didn't know and I thought I was good and I wasn't good. I didn't listen to my teachers and I wasn't really inspired and concept art wasn't a field yet. So I didn't feel like I had anyone to look up to in terms of my teachers. There were a lot of illustration teachers. And illustration teachers, everyone had their own independent style. And one of the interesting things about art school and teachers at art school is there's just so many blowhards. Like, it's intense. And I remember when I taught, I was thinking about, have I become that guy? And I realized, yeah, a little bit. I think so. Because there's something inherently corrupting about the amount of power a teacher has. Because no matter what, you know, where you're at in your normal day-to-day life, you walk into that classroom and you have 30 people that listen to every utterance you say and take it as gospel, you know? And, you know, I didn't enjoy school for that exact same reason. I don't think I had a lot of teachers that felt like they could be argued with or they could, you know, adhere to different opinions. And they also all had strong artistic styles, but they didn't see how their style, a lot of them, they didn't see how their style was their style. They proclaimed that it was fundamentals. So you'd have an illustration teacher who had this, like, let's say, in illustration, there's a couple of art styles that are very crude on purpose, especially in the early 2000s. And that kind of awkward drawings and awkward line works great for illustration. for a concept artist, it doesn't apply as much. And I didn't like it personally. Now, I actually do like it now in retrospect. I love all those teacher styles now. But at the time, I didn't like it. I thought it was gross. But you couldn't find a teacher that had the ability to say, this is what I'm teaching because this is the style I'm teaching. And because these are the things I specifically like myself, but they're not universal. They all claimed it was universal. Every teacher hid behind that mantle of what I'm teaching is fundamentals. And it's above critique and reproach. And I think that's just something that I think inherently happens with teaching. And, you know, when I teach my class, I teach it like a dictator, too, because I think what I'm saying is 100% right. And I'm open to feedback, but I think it comes down to, do you like that teacher's style? Do you agree with their artistic sensibility and their taste? And therefore, do you listen to what they have to say? Now, I think a mature person would see what best they could get from every teacher, regardless of the style. Mm. But I wasn't mature, so I was just an asshole. So I think after art school, because of all that, I kind of didn't really have a portfolio that was any good, and I didn't have a style that that was really evolved. And so I worked at a restaurant in my hometown, which is, you know, basically the saddest thing that could happen to you, because a restaurant in your hometown is like your parents' friends coming in and asking you, oh, that's great, you went to art school and you're a loser now? That's fantastic. And they're actually secretly pleased because their kid went to law school and is doing something with their lives, and you went to art school and you're working in fine dining. So that was definitely, I think, what's that?
The starving artist.
Exactly. And to them, especially because I grew up in a relatively like affluent town, to them that was exactly as it should be. Hmm. You were born a loser and you will die a loser because art has no field, you know? But the cool thing was, and I think this is one advantage, is that I was supremely lazy in that I wasn't about to do anything else. Like, I had no ability to compromise. And it wasn't because I was so sturdy as a person or I was so single-minded. It was because I just was too weak to compromise. I was like, this is what I'm doing. Like, I can't do anything else. I don't want to do anything else. And I think at the end, that saved me a little bit because it helped me to say, all right, well, if it takes 100 years, I'm going to keep working in this restaurant until I get a job. And I reworked on my portfolio. I finessed it. I kept adding pieces to it. And I eventually got an offer, two offers, in fact, one in Colorado and one in Chicago at two different companies. And the Colorado one was Idle Minds, which made a game called Neopets, The Darkest Fairy. And it was a cartoony game, and cartoony was what I liked. So I took the job, and it was about a year after I graduated school. And I actually had competing offers. Both companies wanted me. Nothing for a year, and then I got competing offers. And I took the job in Colorado and really enjoyed it. Stayed there for about a year or two. The game came out. It didn't do that well, but I had made a lot of great friends in Colorado. And, you know, I had hated L.A. so much because Art Center is in Pasadena, and Pasadena is so far from the beach, and my friends were spread out all over the city, and I was poor, and I was driving there a lot to see my friends wherever they lived at UCLA or USC. And, you know, L.A. is a nightmarish place to live if you have to drive anywhere. Hmm. It's really, in my opinion, one of the worst American cities. But if you stay where you are, I think it's one of the best. And especially if you have some disposable income, because being a poor, starving student in L.A. and having to drive, getting a parking ticket will ruin your life. But as an adult, I was adamant that I was never going back to L.A. And then Naughty Dog, a friend of mine worked at Naughty Dog, called me and said, hey, they're doing this Jack and Daxter game, PSP game. Do you want to come and work on it? And it was Sky Pirates. And I said, yeah, because the company I'm at just released this Neopets, The Darkest Fairy. It sold something like 70,000 copies, which I didn't know what it meant at the time, but it's bad news. And the company was letting go of a lot of people. And, you know, concept was the last to go, for sure, because we needed to concept whatever new thing we decided to do. So, you know, our jobs weren't in jeopardy, but it was me and one other guy. But I decided, okay, I want to go work on Sky Pirates. Like, that'll be really fun. And I'll go to L.A., but it's in Santa Monica, so I'm going to live in Santa Monica. I'm not driving anywhere. I'm not making any friends outside of the city. If someone's in Pasadena and it's their birthday, we're not friends anymore because I'm just not going. And I think if you live LA that way, you lose a lot of friends, which is good, and you keep only friends that live within a few miles of you, and you actually can build a community of people, and you can know the person at the Starbucks, and you can ride your bike everywhere. And now everyone I know lives close to me. But so that was the impetus to come to LA again. And a week after I started, of course, they pulled the plug on the Jack and Daxter game and said, do you want to work on Uncharted? Now, keep in mind, I had done a concept test for Uncharted before I had done one for the Sky Pirates game, because I just, as a personal challenge, I wanted to do it. And I remember they looked at my concept test and just said, no, thank you. And I had spent like 30 hours on it. Now, that's not unusual now. Naughty Dog still does that. They do concept tests and they do art tests that take 30, 40 hours. And then, sorry, too bad. So I was pissed a little bit. But then when they invited me for the Sky Pirates, I'm like, great. I don't want to work on that stupid guy in a jungle T-shirt game anyway. So I worked on the Jack and Daxter. They pulled the plug and they said, you want to work on Uncharted? Or do you want to be fired? So I went with not being fired. I remember we discussed this last time a little bit, and I basically, you know, hated that game and that style of game, and phoned it in for 2 years. Again, not really knowing what my style was, not really knowing how photos or – we're really far from getting to 3D at this point. Mm-hmm. But not knowing how photos or 3D was going to incorporate into concept art, not knowing any of these processes, just understanding the traditional processes, which is like you sketch it out and you do it in black and white, and then you flesh it out from there and you – figure out all the textures with brushwork. Now, obviously, we're a long ways off from that nowadays. But at the time, that was kind of what people maybe did. And everyone who did it, the exception of maybe a Craig Mullins here and there, their work looked disgusting. You know, you can imagine there was an era of gross-looking concept art. You know, and some people are still in it. But it evolved, and a few people, you know, started leading the pack, doing unique things, and you'd see their artwork, and you would think, oh, great, well, that's a path I can go down. But because I wasn't looking at anybody's art, I think I spent 2 years maybe phoning it in. And I remember I've been told later that there was a meeting about firing me. They, you know, the lead artist got together and they said, you know, we have to fire this guy because he's half it. But thankfully, you know, Naughty Dog has a policy of giving losers one last chance. So they're like, all right, dude, you're about to be fired. So what are you going to do? And, you know, oftentimes people do end up getting fired once they're in that position, because I'd seen it happen to several other people after. But in that case, I freaked out and started getting it together a little bit and started seeing some art, like I'd mentioned, like by Mache or some of the other artists. We hired a couple new artists that had some really interesting, cool, more photorealistic styles that I thought looked good, too. And, you know, because we started hiring a few more concept artists, because back in that time, there was only one or two concept artists for a whole project. But we started hiring more, and we started to build a little bit of a community. I started to look at other concept artists' work, which I hadn't done in 6 years. I'd never in my life looked at another concept artist's work. That's how much of an egomaniac I was. And then I started to learn from other people and be humbled. But I think the turning point was Uncharted 1 came out, and I played it. And I got it. I was like, whoa, I see why this guy had to have a white T-shirt on. Because as a concept artist, that's really ridiculous to see a guy in a white T-shirt and jeans and think to yourself, that's the character design that we're going with, really? But the reason was because it wasn't about the concept artist and it wasn't about us getting to express our flamboyant, you know, awful sense of character design. This isn't Final Fantasy. This was a game that was designed to be like Indiana Jones. And the guy was just a person telling a story. He wasn't a video game character. And that's what made the game good. It was telling a story that you could buy. And I think when the character doesn't look completely ridiculous, you believe the lines of dialogue they're saying. But if they have two giant horns and fangs and purple eyes that are glowing, you can't buy that they're saying anything that has any emotional gravity. So when I had realized that, and that Amy, who was the, you know, creative director, game director at the time, Amy Henning, that's what she was going for. Now, granted, it would have been nice if she told us. But who's got time to sit everyone at the company down and be like, hey, listen, this is the vision we're going for, and this is why we're doing it. Because I didn't know that for 3 years until I played the game, I didn't know that that's what we were trying to do. And when I played it, I was like, I got it. I was like, oh, you're trying to tell us an actual story. You're not trying to make a video game. And I think all students, all kids, everyone who starts out, wants to do something that is allows them to maximum express their creativity. So they're drawn towards Final Fantasy, and they're drawn towards League of Legends, World of Warcraft, anything that allows them to be all about that individual character design. It's all about me and my design. Look at me and my design. But designing something nuanced and subtle that only fits as a slice of the puzzle, a piece of the puzzle for a much bigger picture you're trying to do, that's a lot harder. It's a lot harder to explain. And for me, it took almost getting fired and then actually playing the game to be convinced that that was a valid, you know, way to design things.
Yeah, you talked about the storytelling side of it. I know last time we had talked, which if you haven't had a chance, put a link to this in the show notes, but we do have an interview that we've done with Shaddy going over the zones of awesomeness, storytelling being one of those, but also cheatinginess and sexiness and classiness. When we talked, you had mentioned that there's almost a new one every week. Are there any more that you've come across since then?
Yes. Well, you know, there's a new one mainly in the cheatiness category because the other three are a little more fundamental. Those are a little more like high thoughts on art that don't change. Mm-hmm. But it's really only in the cheatiness where things change. Like, yeah, for example, there's a program called World Machine, which is a terrain generation program. Mm-hmm. And we have some new jobs coming out that are going to require a lot of like fantasy terrain. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if it's viable. I've seen people use it. I've seen some demos of it. I've seen people post on Facebook about it. I've seen colleagues discuss it. So what I might ask from my guys is be like, hey, I'm going to give you a four-hour budget to look into World Machine, see if it works for you. Maybe it's good, maybe it's not. But keep in mind, the goal is the goal. So if we're doing some awesome volcano planet and you find a picture of an awesome volcano, I don't want you to use World Machine's generically generated rock terrain in lieu of the great photo just because you know how to use it.
Right.
Like, it's hard to look at a new technology, like, for example, the possibility of using the software and think, is it actually useful? Because it generates rock terrain, sure, but it's certainly not going to have the variety of geology that a real terrain has, because real terrain would be like sediments over thousands of years, and then it lifted up, and then it rained, and then a section of it broke off. So there's no way World Machine simulates things to that degree, but to some degree. So it's up to the artist. Hopefully they have the wherewithal to decide whether that new cheatiness is applicable in this case. Maybe it's only applicable in an underwater scene. Maybe it's good for something else. But that would be one example.
Hmm. So what are some of the biggest issues that you see kind of happening in concept art, the whole industry right now?
I think overall, all the issues that are happening, any like issue is a strong word because it means it's like a big problem. It's yeah. not, because anything that anyone else does that isn't good is good for us because we do it. I feel like we do an awesome job of it. So yeah. I'm not upset that everybody doesn't know how to make things the way I would think they look good, because if they did, then we'd have to step it up 100-fold.
Right.
So it's not an issue. But the situation is, yeah, for a starting artist or anyone who wants to get work, is that maybe they have conflicted directions they're being pulled in terms of like what they want to do with their concept art. You know, obviously the cheatiness section is more specific to one pixel brush, mm-hmm. I think, and maybe other studios and probably a lot of people, but the other three sections are universal. I think everyone would agree on them, but the cheatiness, that's one where like there might be art purists who don't believe in cheating to that degree or using all those different techniques for doing things. But everyone who does levels up. And like I'd mentioned before, I've seen people like John Sweeney, who is a Naughty Dog, amazing concept artist. And I saw him in 6 months go from being what I would consider abysmal to in his senior show to professional level concept. And it was me and Eitan. I mean, he was friends with us, so we could help him. He had access to us, two people that were both working at Naughty Dog, and I wasn't anymore, but Eitan was, and could actively help him specifically look at his painting and give him feedback on his concept test. And he listened to it. So I think the biggest challenge for young, for people, anyone doing concept art, is they're just not willing to even try a new thing. You know, and if not even willing to try it, like, and it's really hard. I feel the same thing. If someone tells me some new technique, like, for example, this world machine thing, for example, and I was going to do a painting, I kind of don't want to bother. I kind of just want to do it using the many techniques I already know. But maybe if I spend 4 hours going down a road that may lead to nowhere, I might learn a new thing. So I think always being open to going down these new roads, especially, I mean, it's a no-brainer if someone who's a pro and whose work you like tells you to do something and you're like, okay, I kind of believe them, but I kind of don't. It's like, what? Are you insane? Like, I remember I took a workshop. I was teaching an outdoor painting class, outdoor digital landscape painting, at Art Center, being that blowhard teacher that I hated. And after I finished, I taught a couple semesters, and I got busy with work, so I couldn't do it anymore. Head of department asked me, do you want to come back and teach? Can you please come back and teach? And I said, I don't have the time to drive to Pasadena because it's a five-hour class. It's too much work. And a couple weeks later, he says, all right, well, actually, we got Jamie Jones to do it. And Jamie Jones is, you know, one of the best concept artists that there is. And he has a very painterly style that looks beautiful because it looks traditionally painterly. And then I had to send him another email and be like, I found the time to come to that class, not to teach it, though. So I will be there, but I won't be teaching it. So I went to about half of Jamie's classes. He was teaching my class, but he's so much better than me that I thought, oh, I'm going to learn a shitload from this guy. And what's amazing is I had some hard, fast techniques that I told him about, and I told him how I was teaching outdoor landscape painting, and he was like, that's really stupid. Why would you do it that way? And specifically, it was something where I told my guys to block everything out when they're doing a landscape painting from life, block everything out with values, and get all the shapes sorted out in black and white. So you'd have like five layers in your Photoshop file, and it'd all be hard, flat, crisp values, no gradients or anything, just crisp outlined values. And you design all the shapes in black and white, then you would go back and color it. You know, each one, each layer independently, you would color it. And I told Jamie I did this, and he's like, that's just, he couldn't even help himself. He didn't mean to insult me. He was just like, that's stupid. Like, why would you do it that way? I was like, well, what do you do? He's like, well, I draw it first, you know? I was like, yeah, but drawing it, you don't get as clear of a sense of what the shapes are if you don't fill it in with solid color. And he's like, yeah, but drawing it is better. And as I took the class, I realized why. It's because he would draw it, and after he would do a drawing, he would immediately start blocking in color. And when you would watch him paint, it was interesting because I don't think he even fully knew how good he was. So he would just start blocking in color the same way you would do traditionally if you started a painting, doing some underpainting, painting the sky. But you would notice every time he made a stroke of doing a piece of the sky, his strokes would be carefully spaced from each other, quickly but carefully. So his strokes all had gaps in between them a little bit. And then when he painted the tree line, it would come close to where the sky was, but it wouldn't quite touch it. And that's, again, how you would paint traditionally. Now, the end effect of that is the painting had this really beautiful, rich, painterly vibe because there was all these openings kind of where you could see underpainting. So it looked more painterly. Whereas my technique was about filling in flat color, like more methodical. You were on rails kind of. You fill in the flat color and then you'd color it in. You'd try to get some of that with the coloring it in. You kind of could, but it was a much more methodical process. His was a lot more off rails. It was a lot more like no training wheels, just freestyle. After the line drawing, then you just freestyle it. And I realized he's thinking about every mark. Every mark he's thinking very carefully about placing it. It takes a lot of concentration. What I was trying to do is build this giant armature, this exoskeleton, just methodically. And then when it was done, I would just fill it in. And it took a lot less brain power. And it was almost an epiphany to realize that Jamie actually thinks about every mark. Like, how stressful is that? Like, it takes concentration the whole time. Whereas mine only took concentration for like a couple hours out of the 7 or 8 hours I worked on. So that was a scenario in which his technique was different than a technique that I've been teaching forever. And I changed my technique because he's good. So why wouldn't I? Like, I look at his paintings and I like them better than mine. So why don't I do what the guy who's better than me does? And not doing that is insane. And tons of people don't do it because they feel like art belongs to them somehow. Like their technique is them. They're connected to it because it's part of their self-expression. Like some, there's like this general sense in human society that artists are some sort of inspired race of beings, and that our inspiration and everything is part of an expression of who we are, because we've seen too many movies about Basquiat. You know, we're not fine artists, first of all. So what you're saying is not a unique expression. You're doing a commercial art, but also we're always heading towards beauty. We're not exploring the world of what art could be. We're trying to create beautiful things. It's a completely different goal. And there's some leeway for technique and personal expression within that, but not the same as a traditional turn of the century fine artist, what we think of a contemporary artist. We're not doing that. But some of those ideas about what an artist is, people are still connected to and attached to. The layman is, and some artists are too. So I think that's what prevents people from taking on somebody else's technique.
So some of those, you have had a very different approach than Jamie did. Does the style of concept that you're going towards, like whether it's a cartoony or more realistic style, does that determine which technique you use at that point? Like, is you're roughing it in still valid, just for a different style?
Yes. I think, on the Jamie thing, it was only as it applies to outdoor painting. So if we were doing a painting, if we were doing anything that was like either realistic or cartoony, we probably wouldn't approach it the same way. Because for most jobs we get, and this may change in the future, but for example, a one pixel brush, it depends on the client. Okay, let's just say we got a Kung Fu Panda type client and a Call of Duty type client. So those are two clients that want the end result to look like what the game looks like. So when I have guys do concept art, because it's so easy and we can cheat and use photos in 3D, I just say your style should be close to what the final product will look like, within reason. There might be a little bit of play, but there's not nearly as much play as you would have in an outdoor painting, where the painterliness is the purpose. For me, with our clients right now, unless someone specifically asked for something painterly, I would say we're trying to make it look like what the final game looks like. And that may be a limited view, because we could definitely influence the look of a game if we gave them some unique art. And I feel like if we expanded, if One Pixel Brush ever became involved in a more intimate way with designing the whole art direction for a game, and we had access to the texture artists and the modelers, and we were creating the style for something from scratch, and we could determine every aspect of it, then I think it would be worth exploring style a little bit more. But as it stands, we're only going to go for the style that the client's end product looks like, I think, because I think that makes sense for them, unless we have a reasonable way to affect their style. Now, a lot of concept art directors and a lot of people in the industry, they got there because they love art. So they would be okay with us showing them more painterly stuff, I think, possibly. They'd think, oh, that's cool. This is inspiration art. But I think for me, that's a throwback to a time when that's all we could do. But now we can make it look exactly like the end product. So why wouldn't we? And if you want the end product to be painterly or have a different style, like, for example, the Pixar short that just came out, there was Paper Man, and then there was a new one called Feast about this dog who was getting fed. And it was amazing. And it had a totally unique style. And that seems like a style that was driven by art. They had an art, well, not seems like, it definitely was. It was a style where they had this really cel-shaded, toony style they were trying to do in 3D. And they adapted the tech to the art style. And that's amazing and beautiful. It's a great thing. But as an outsourcing studio, we don't try to do that as much. Although I definitely think it's something worthwhile. I just feel like we'd have to be more involved in their technology in order to push something like that.
You know, you had mentioned this idea of cheatiness, right? Which as you're talking about, it's learning from other people as you did in the class, right? Learning different techniques. Has there ever been a time when someone hasn't been so forthcoming with what they know and maybe gotten upset or had the wrong idea and not understood cheatiness with you?
Like someone who heard what I was saying about it and then got mad.
Yeah, or someone you approached and weren't as forthcoming about their technique and thought, this is mine. You know, they had that attitude you were expressing a while ago where this is mine, I didn't get it from anywhere, and it belongs to me. and I'm not going to be willing to share it, which is sort of a ridiculous attitude to have, as I think you'd agree.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of concept artists like that. Some that I respect, and I think their work is amazing, and I get why they don't share it. And some who are just assholes, and who are suffering for it. But sometimes you get to the top of the mountain, and you have no reason to let anyone know how you got there. You know?
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's wrong. Because why would you teach the competition? You know? Now, in the long term, I think that maybe hurts you because you learn as much from other people, maybe not as much, but having an open attitude just from like a spiritual perspective, I think helps you because you learn from others and others learn from you. That's how arts grow. That's how people grow. That's how societies grow. But if you're someone who put in, you know, hundreds of thousands more hours than anyone else to learn all these amazing techniques that you only learn because you traveled by yourself down all these tasks that, like I was saying, the world machine, that was one example. But like, if you've done that all the time for 10 years, 20 years, and you learned a million more techniques than anybody else, and you're better than everybody else by a long shot because of these techniques, and you don't want to share them because you don't want anyone else to catch up to you, you want to be the best by far, I get that. I don't blame you. And it would be unfair for me to say that I don't have an interest. For me, it's not, I don't have the same motivation as that superstar because I'm trying to get people to be good because it helps my business. Mm-hmm. I have a financial interest in it. That person has a financial interest in not doing that. So I can philosophize about why it's good or bad, but there's certainly people who don't share stuff, and I get why. I wish they would. Obviously, it benefits everybody, but there definitely are people that don't.
Is there one thing that you would change if you could about the gaming industry? What would it be?
Yeah, I think the gaming industry is changing mainly because the generation that made it, that started the game industry, they'll die eventually.
We'll all die.
And I think that any industry that's as young as gaming, I think gaming is generally has been about the games. You know, about the gameplay.
Yeah.
Just like chess is about the strategy of the game. But the person who designed chess maybe doesn't know what a relationship between a pawn and a queen really would be. Do you know what I mean? Like if they were humans. They don't know what the psychological relationship between a queen and a pawn would be. And I think that's the situation that gaming has been wrestling with in the past 10 years. Is that guy just knows the pawn should move two spaces forward and a queen can move in any direction and we got to balance it so it's not unfair. But then that same guy has been in the industry for 15, 20 years. So now someone says, well, what's motivating this pawn to go forward two spaces? And he's like, well, maybe he's pissed off because he's got a grudge because his mom was killed in a car accident. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, that sounds like what you saw in every movie collected in your brain. But it doesn't mean like, you know, the first thing about what it is to be a human being or how to tell a story or that you've investigated within your own heart and brain and soul about what motivates living humans. You have no idea. And I don't have any idea. I know. I think I know something, but that's a professional writer. That's a professional storyteller. That's a whole separate art. Mm-hmm. And I think some people are getting it there. Like, you know, Last of Us, I think, got really close. Uncharted, even, I really liked. I think Neil Druckmann, the creative director of Naughty Dog, is an amazing example of someone who trained himself in storytelling. And I watched it happen over the course of 6 years. He trained himself. He was in workshops. He was reading. He was writing comic books on his own. This was something he had passion for separate from the job he had. And then when an opportunity arose for him to pitch an idea for a new game, he had it thought out really carefully. And he has a way better ear and eye and feeling for what human relationships are or how he sees them than your average game developer. And part of it is because I think he kind of he had a daughter kind of around the time that the game came out, he was developing the game. So that idea that Last of Us was dealing with, which what is more valuable, the life of one person you love or the life of everybody in the world? I think that's kind of an idea that resonated with him because he cared so much for his family, cared so much for his daughter. It was really personal to him. Whereas I think most games are not developed with that much, with the person who's in charge of that vision doesn't have that much heart. They don't have that much thought about what it is. They're just like, it's more about ego for them. It's about, like I said, grizzled man with one scar across his eye, ex-Navy SEAL is out for vengeance. That's an emotion that a 14-year-old can understand. But I think Neil went into some emotions that a grown-up could understand. And like I said, he's, you know, my age, he's a younger generation of game developer. He rose to where he is really quickly. So he got fresh, he got a fresh perspective, a fresh mind, fresh eyes on the way it was done. He's highly intelligent. And it comes down to him and Bruce Straley, who's the game director for Last of Us, working really collaboratively, those two guys together as a dream team of vision that made that game happen. Because you need someone who's cracking the whip and keeping it on course every single time. There was a funny anecdote I heard about the development, because I had left Last of Us after about a year of pre-production to start One Pixel Brush. And one of the artists had developed, which I thought was really funny, towards the end of the game, the emotional climax, there was an RV that you could go into to just get weapons or items. It was just off the path. And it was a time when tensions were really high between the two characters in the game. And they had decided, one of the artists had decided to make the RV from Breaking Bad. So it looked exactly like the Breaking Bad RV. They had that stuff in there, had all this different, like, fun kind of Easter eggs for Breaking Bad. And I heard a story about, you know, Neil and Bruce going in there, seeing the RV, and being like, what the f*** are you talking about? Throw that shit away. Take it out. And everyone was so disappointed, because you're like, what's the big deal? You're playing a video game. What's wrong with a little Easter egg? You know, you're playing the game. But Neil had a vision about what the emotional tone of this story is. He wasn't making it like a guy who's making a video game. He was making it like a human being trying to tell a story. And he said, just going into this van and seeing this Breaking Bad Easter egg take you out of the story. If it does, why on earth would we put it in? Yeah. And that's a kind of, it's extreme seeming, but it's an example of a shift in focus in what a video game is and should be that those guys have that I think made that game so good.
I think that's a really good point about what you might call the encroachment of other popular culture. For example, I think I might understand what he felt by seeing the Breaking Bad RV as an encroachment of another series, another form of art into my own vision. And I get to thinking of that when you were talking a while ago about what does it mean? What does real art mean in the sense that if people are deriving what they're going to express ultimately, whether it's in painting or drawing or 3D, where are they getting the source for that inspiration? Is it from living a life, right? Or is it from scenes that they read in comic books, things that they see in movies? Do you see that is part of it, that's becoming more of an inspiration, other works of art as opposed to living? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I think that's definitely the case. And I think if it errs too much in that direction without the individual knowing what it is to be a human, like I said, real life experiences, like me and my buddies, we've done trips all over the world to do outdoor painting, digital outdoor painting, the same class I taught. We went to Europe for a month. We went to Moab. I went to Tibet on a research trip for Uncharted. And those are amazing trips because they give you real fresh eyes on things and they add little details that you may not have known about. But, and I think a lot of artists in film too, they take mainly from their favorite movies and influences. And I think you can do that to some degree. Like Chappie, for example, that was a really cool idea for a movie, having that police robot. And I know that just like Neil likes zombies, he loves zombie genre. And that's not necessarily the most unique genre in the world, but he loved Children of Men and he loved The Road. And when Last of Us, again, just like Uncharted, when Last of Us first came on the scene as a thought, it wasn't unique, not even remotely unique. Not only was it not unique, it was based almost really similarly to two movies that already existed that were successful, that were popular, that everybody knows about, that were kind of the same story about a man protecting. But when you talk to them and said, why are you doing this? You know, I didn't say it directly, but like, you know, this is kind of like those things. They're like, yeah, but it's never been done in games. So it's unique to games. So that makes it unique. And to me, it kind of taught me a little bit about, you know, doing something, but doing it better can be okay. It doesn't have to be completely unique as long as you execute it amazingly well. And then back to your point about, you know, movies versus real life. Certainly, Neil was influenced a lot by other films. That was where he got the whole inspiration from it. But he tapped into something in terms of the way the dialogue felt based on studying it hard and feeling like what's natural and what feels good to him. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying the industry has nowhere to go. It's not like Last of Us is the greatest, you know, thing piece of art done in the history of mankind, but like there, it's definitely just a step closer,
sure.
A step more sensitive, a step more nuanced. But yeah, I think most artists, like you're kind of alluding to, is our headphones down, indoor kids. Yeah. And I know when we talked this after a painting class at Art Center, half the fun was we got to go outside and on hikes and trips. Mm-hmm. And we saw a baby rattlesnake one time. And we were scaling down a cliff one time. Mm-hmm. And all the kids were, like, helping each other up the cliff. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of slippery. I mean, there was, like, we went down to a shipwreck, the Dominator shipwreck in Palos Verdes. We went out to the Malibu Canyon. We did all these kind of adventures. And these kids had never been outside. I don't think most of them hadn't been on a hike ever. So that was the outdoor painting, I think, and the digital outdoor painting is an excuse to, like, hey, take your Photoshop skills and your brushes and all your stuff that you know and go plop yourself out in a real place. I think that really helps you to open your eyes to, like, hey, the world is real. Mm-hmm. And your references can come or should come to some degree from real life. At the same time, we're all nerds and we all think awesome is awesome. So the idea of a Chappie Chekhov robot is really cool. Or the idea of zombies apocalypse and you protecting this last person because there's a zombie apocalypse.
Sure.
It's a cool trope that we can use as long as I think you kind of grab from both. And then the storytelling part, like I said, that's not in my specialty. That's not in most artists' specialty. That's a different talent we're talking about that exists in some people and that has to do with games, but not necessarily directly with concept art or art the way we're talking about it because it's just a different job. So in acknowledging it's a different job, I think, is important.
Yeah, I mean, we're not known, or people in the gaming industry in particular aren't known for being, you know, that outgoing, that social, right? Having experiences with other people. I mean, there's a big difference between watching a movie or playing a game of human interaction within a scene, right? Say a love scene or something, and actually going out and having one of those, which I think. You have, that's where you get your inspiration. You may get the form, the technical form from watching something and gathering references from popular culture. But if you don't sort of start with that sort of human connection with either other people or with nature or, you know, like as you were describing, that I think it sort of becomes empty. And I think that the gaming industry has everywhere to go in that direction, and it's really exciting to see it moving that way.
Absolutely. And I'll say this, too, about personality is that, you know, I have a more outgoing personality, so I tended to think that was the right way to be. Mm-hmm. But my most talented guys don't. They're really quiet, and they're really on the shy side. Even after I've been known for 3 years, they're really soft-spoken. They think a lot before they respond. They're just not outgoing, and they never will be. And they're some of the best artists I've ever seen in my life. So I think part of it, I used to think I was biased towards outgoingness and loudness, but I think that really quiet, really shy people, yeah, can have more. Everyone can go outside. You don't have to be outgoing to go outside, but you can still have any kind of personality and have amazing art. You don't have to be like an outgoing person. I mean, it helps if you're going to manage people or try to lead a team, but I think you could still do that even with a really quiet, shy personality. If your work is really good and you can say what you think to some degree, you can be hugely successful even if you're really shy. And I think that's important to mention because there's a lot of artists out there who don't have that big, loud personality. And they're like, how am I going to break into the industry? I'm not good at networking. I don't like talking to people. That is peripheral. If your work is amazing and you can barely speak, I'll still hire the crap out of you. That's like most of my, it's half my team maybe.
Yeah. 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 Not to imply that you had to be outgoing necessarily as much as you just have to have something to say, which I think a lot of times comes from either introspection.
And those guys have a lot to say as artists too. Yeah. Like they're somehow like also the most like varied and have the most varied taste and are very keen watchers of everything around them. So they're much more informed.
Yeah. With your team, I know most of your team or all of it is actually working remotely. Is there any advice that you can give for other people who are working with remote artists and trying to help them along with that? Because a lot of artists that are very quiet and so on may not be the ones to bring up issues or bring up problems or bring up suggestions or that aspect. How are some of the ways that you can help your team grow in that way?
Well, what I do is, because I just finished actually listening to this book, this audiobook, I'm listening to a lot of business audiobooks recently. There's one by Ed Catmull called Creativity Inc., which was the founder of Pixar. And he had a lot of awesome advice. And there was one called Good to Great by this guy, John Collins. Good to Great is a famous business book. It's been around for a really long time. It's considered like one of the great business books. But one of the interesting things he said is that, you know, they studied all these companies and they picked like 15 that had beat the market by 3 times and had stayed over the course of 15 years. They held specific criteria, 3 out of 400. And one of the interesting things they found was that none of those companies had CEOs with big personalities. They didn't have a lot of interviews. They weren't in the news a lot. They didn't care about the limelight. And the reason those companies were successful is because they had leaders who were about the company before themselves. So although there are companies with genius leaders, they would tend to hire people that could execute their genius, rightly so, because they were geniuses. But then when they left, there was no more genius. So the whole infrastructure was based around disseminating and executing on a visionary's genius. But all these other CEOs were not about that. They were about building genius in others. And it was a dramatic shift of sort of perspective and paradigm. And when that was the case, when that guy left, usually his successor was better than him. And one of the other points they made was that dealing with the problem with a big personality is that people are afraid to confront you and they're afraid to tell you what the problems are. And sometimes they call them the creepy crawlies in the book. Sometimes there's a lot of creepy crawlies under the rocks and you're afraid to turn over the rocks. But if you want to be a diligent leader, you have to actively just turn over every rock and see where all the bugs are. Knowing where they are helps you nip problems in the bud. So, you know, after reading that, and I feel like I was doing that to some degree, but I try to push that more, is I try to have not reviews once a year, but every couple weeks or so, I'll talk to one of my guys on the phone and I'll take their temperature. Like, how's this working out for you? Like, I mean, it's not uncommon for me to ask a guy, maybe who's more on the shy side, to be like, you know, did that painting ruin your life? Did it drain you emotionally because it was too technical? That's a valid question because I want to know. You know, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. Maybe I've had some artists be like, I hate working on these ship changeovers. They crush my spirit because I want to do my own concept. I don't want to texture somebody else's design. And the business side of me is like, it's your job. Why don't you do it and shut up? And then the artist side of me is like, I totally get it. Who would want to do that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I have to seek out the answers and try to find problems, actively look for problems before they become problems, especially with quiet artists, and especially because I'm overbearing and loud, and people might have a harder time telling me what they really think. So that's on me, and I think anyone who's in this position, whether you have a big or small personality, I think from that book, Pixar especially, makes an active effort to constantly go in there and like root out what the problems with communication are. And it's an ongoing thing, and problems aren't bad. From Ed's perspective, he was specific about problems aren't bad. They're great. That means you're making progress and it never stops. So you shouldn't look at them as something to fear. You should look at problems as something to look forward to and find. And that's what that helped me a lot.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate the chat. It's always great getting your insights and advice. And I know we could go on forever, but we be respectful of your time.
Unfortunately, we have
No worries. No, that was fun. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
It was really nice meeting you. I got to hear your talk at GDC, and I was really impressed with it. Yeah. But it's really good to hear you in person and all your ideas.
In person over the phone.
Awesome. Well, thanks for all the awesome questions, guys, and I really appreciate your time, too. I mean, the article you wrote was great, and I'm looking forward to re-listening to this one.
Definitely great. Yeah, we'll have to keep in touch.
You know, Shaddy's, he's a really articulate dude. I mean, he knows how to express things well, and he knows a lot. I mean, it's obvious from listening to him that he's done quite a bit of, like,
he's got
travel.
A lot of experience in the industry.
He's done a lot of soul searching, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, he understands himself, you know. He understands where he came from, where he made his mistakes. It's clear to him the problems that he faced and where he wants to go. And I think he has a great head on his shoulder. He seems to have really good business sense. And it was a joy really listening to his story.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. I think he's seen both sides. So he's experienced both sides of being that artist as he admitted of just phoning it in for a while, right? When it was working on something that maybe he wasn't passionate about, but then it's turning it around. And you can obviously tell that he's just so passionate about what he's doing right now. And if you go on their website, we'll put the link in the show notes, onepixelbrush.com. Amazing, amazing work coming out of that studio.
Yeah, I think he hit upon one of the biggest motivators for him was, you know, when he was in that state of mind I don't really care, I'm just boning this in, you're not going to have a job.
Yeah.
So,
And it's something a lot of artists come across, right? If you're working on a project that maybe you're not as passionate about, it can be really hard to make yourself be passionate about that or make yourself work on it regardless so that you can build that passion.
It's a hard commodity. I mean, not everybody has that sort of self-drive, and understandably so, because it's difficult. I don't know, sometimes that's really important to have that motivation from a lower perspective of, I need to eat, I need to pay my rent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's Maslow's hierarchy, right? Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, it was really good. Getting into the idea of cheatiness, I thought was really good.
Yeah. And as I mentioned it on the call, but if you haven't, we do have a series of articles. We'll put a link in the show notes. But in one of those, Shadi does go over the four zones of awesomeness. And there's a diagram on there that you can look at and see that he's created as well. Really brilliant way of kind of consolidating high-end AAA level concept art into, these are the things that you need to do in order to create this beautiful artwork, as much as can be expected, right? I mean, obviously things always change.
Right. Yeah. And it's more like, you know, you think of like technical things you want to do, but it's not. It's really like, what kind of attitude do you need, right? In order to survive in this? Well, one of the things is you need to be willing to listen to other people and actively seek out what he calls the gods of your god of
art,
god, right?
Yeah.
The person that you look up to and want to aspire to, and don't be afraid to listen and go after that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
If you've got any questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us at our Facebook and Twitter pages.
Or you can find us on the Digital Tutors blog at blog.digitaltutors.com, and we'll be sure to put all of those links in the show notes. Thanks for listening.